Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Philip Camella, who is the author of The Collapse of Materialism, Visions of Science, Dreams of God. Philip is an attorney, a visionary futurist, and host of a popular radio show, Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, and is here to talk today about, I guess, the idea of the world, the universe as we know it, either as a great machine or a great thought. Welcome, Philip. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really good being here. I appreciate it.
Well, would you like to give the listeners a little bit of your background and how you came to write a very, I guess, thorough and interesting view of worldviews?
Well, first of all, I've always had a deep driving desire to figure it all out, and I don't think this is an uncommon trait, but it's really deep in me. So I studied philosophy in college, and it's like anything else. To figure things out, I think it means to reconcile competing ideas. And the two big competing ideas out there are science and religion, and the two different mindsets we bring to each of those. And so I've devoted half of my life to figuring it all out and putting it down on a piece of paper. And so what drives me is to put the picture of our world in one piece. We know that we live in one world. We have one mind. There should be one worldview that explains everything. And that's what I set myself out to do, and so that's the foundation of it.
So in the book, it mentions ideas from science and then ideas from religion, not just Christianity but all religions.
Right.
And where do you think you go? And then ideas from philosophers, of course. Where do you think you got the first clue that perhaps neither science or religion were correct? Was it from philosophy, what was it from?
Well, I don't think we realize in our modern time that we've really gone down a branch of philosophy called materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And the break really was around the time of Descartes and Newton. Back in the 17th century or so, when modern science was on the rise and science started explaining the mathematical order of the world using a materialistic assumption. And to define my terms, I mean assuming that a real world of matter existed independently of perception, independently of consciousness, independently of mind. And at the same time, though, there's another branch. It really was spearheaded by Descartes, although you can go back to Plato for it. But Descartes was the one that said that that the only thing he could really doubt, or I'm sorry, the only thing he really could not doubt was his own ability to think. I think, therefore, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he doubted that a real world existed independently of the mind. But he then said to himself in his meditations, well, God would not fool me into thinking a real world existed unless one really did. Descartes leads to folks like Berkeley, who came to the conclusion that the world is a vision in the mind of God. So so the point is that we had two different branches. We have idealism, which is mind first, and we have materialism, which is matter first. And we've gone down this path of materialism now in the 21st century, and it's my thesis that materialism is collapsing. It was always a failed worldview. It was always just an assumption, and it's time to move on. So that was really, the beginning of it really is Descartes, Berkeley, Hume, Kant, the foundational thinkers to the Western mindset.
So as we're going down the scientific materialistic path, we come upon quantum physics, which has in its observations that the event cannot exist separate from the observer. So is this kind of a blip in the road that indicates that maybe this theory isn't correct? I mean,
the theory
of materialism.
Right, right. I think that it can be stated that quantum theory disproves materialism, because quantum theory is based upon the findings through scientific experiments that the world does not exist of independent particles. Well, mm-hmm. since these particles are supposed to make up physical reality, the necessary inference is that, therefore, the world does not exist of independent things, such as our bodies, mm-hmm. such as the stars above, the ground, the trees, everything. And I think that one of the problems we're having here in our modern era is that the truths of quantum theory have not permeated the scientific worldview, because quantum theory, it's one of the tenets in my book, is that quantum theory proves the truth of idealism. That's mm-hmm. what it does. It proves that idealism was right after all. And so so we're in an odd state right now, Doctor, where we're sort of balanced between the scientific community holding on with their nails onto materialism, while their main theory of the physical world tells them no such independent material world exists. So it's a really interesting time.
Yeah, there's some other things in quantum theory too that make it difficult to think that materialism is the end and a product of everything, and that would be the idea that things affect each other at a distance, or I think Einstein called it spooky action at a distance or something.
Right, right.
So that's another thing that is observed in quantum theory, but cannot exist if the material world is all that is.
Right, 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 right. The notion of entanglement, right? The notion of
entanglement.
It suggests that there is a unity at the physical level. Now, I happen to think mm-hmm. that the notion of entanglement is sort of a sign that the world is giving us, that what we know and think as the physical world is really united, that it is one thing, that we are not limited in a mechanistic worldview. So I do think entanglement, I mean, let's face it, entanglement drives most physicists crazy. A lot of people,
Einstein.
Yeah, he didn't like it. A lot of people.
He didn't like it.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of funny, because in some ways, you know, science is based upon experiments, but some of these experiments are ignored because
that don't fit in.
right. And it's funny, because I didn't think it was supposed to work like that. I thought you were supposed to follow the experimental results. But I really think there's a section in my book on quantum theory where it sort of says, okay, let's just look at what the experiments show, and you go through the two split experiment, where a lot of people have heard that, and the whole two split experiment showing that particles are really waves and waves are really particles, and you shoot one particle through two slits and it goes through both holes at once. You know, that to me shows that Shakespeare was right, which is that we are the stuff of which dreams are made.
Right.
And that's sort of what it says. And it's just like, well, let's get over this preoccupation with materialism. It was just a model anyways. So let's just not let it rule our lives. Let's get over it. So that's what I'm trying to do here.
I had a dream one time when I was studying metaphysics intently, and I think it was my a higher aspect of myself showing me, the personality, the reality of this. Basically, I was in the dream world, and then I was brought out into a place where it was really between worlds. It was not in either world. Then I was brought into waking reality. Then I was taken back out between worlds. Then I was brought into the dream world about four or five times back and forth. And then I was given the thought that consciousness is projected from a higher level, and both worlds are equally the same thing. So that's what I came up with, was that, just as your book says, the dream world we think is less real, and our physical reality we think is more real, but it is only because we don't really understand that how each is projected, but both are projected in the same way.
Right. And there's a quote from Sir James Jeans that I use sometimes, where he says, and Sir James Jeans was an early 20th century physicist who wrote a couple quasi-mystical books, one of them called The Mysterious Universe, and he said, "Creations of an individual mind may reasonably be called less substantial than creations of a universal mind."
Right.
And that's the same point I make early in the book, which is that look at the power we have individually when we have a big dream, a lucid dream, or when mm-hmm. when we have an hallucination. How is it possible for an individual mind to dream and project a real seeming independent world? Just imagine what a united mind can do. And the answer is, well, we're living in what a united mind can do. That's what we call the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like, oh boy, this is really weird. But the funny thing is that it makes a lot more sense, in my humble opinion, than the current materialistic model with their string theory, multiverses, inflation, and everything else they've got us all wrapped up in. So it really is a function of just taking a different perspective. That's mm-hmm. really what it is. The world stays the same. We treat it differently. We look at it differently.
Yeah, when I was studying this topic, one thing that jumped out at me was the idea that your perceptual reality is limited by your organs of perception. And it's very true that many other life forms, like a dog, can smell more than we can smell. Usually, some of the life forms have ultraviolet perception or infrared perception. So obviously, our organs of perception are limited. And so what we're seeing in the world, we're only seeing based on the limitations of our organs of perception. So there's probably a lot more out there than we're seeing. And if we could see expanded organs of perception, we would then be able to see a lot better what is really what we're projecting. You see, we're projecting individually based on our organs of perception.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would look at that a little differently, but I think I come out pretty close to there, which is that I really think the adjustment that we need to make is looking at the world clearly, looking at the world cleanly, without preconceptions. There's no mm-hmm. doubt that we all bring our own baggage to viewing the world. And let's face it, the older you get, the more baggage we carry. And it's
right.
funny because a lot of us who get a little older, we start engaging in meditation or yoga, or we read books, and we try to open up our mind like we were as children. And
mm-hmm.
and so I do think that the spiritual quest part of it is opening the mind, looking at the world clearly, and appreciating what really exists, which is in my opinion a miracle of the dreaming mind of God. If we look at it like that, it really is. It becomes unlimited, But we are not doing this alone. We are united, and our challenge to make a better world with this principle being a foundational perspective. So it really is a matter of breaking out of the boxes, these belief systems that we have built into our brains. And I'm optimistic that things are a-changing, and we're heading towards a point where we'll have more people taking more of a broad view and not being sort of weighed down by these sort of incomplete, inaccurate, false preconceptions that have built up into our collective minds.
So the religious principle, the spiritual principle of enlightenment, would be something akin to when the individual wakes up to the fact that the world is a greater reality projected from higher levels of consciousness, that rather than the materialistic world. Do you think we're coming on a time when the majority of people will come to that realization, and then that may shift something?
Yeah, I think that's where things are heading. And, you know, then you've got this problem with time. What is time and how long will it take? But there is a field of study, transformation of consciousness or evolution of consciousness, where this is exactly what the topic is. You know, you sort of rise up from thinking that you're the only one, that only your family, your community, your city, your state, your world, and then you take this higher perspective. So I think it's a natural evolution, Susan. I think that it's something that is happening. You know, Darwin is really materialistic in his evolution. I think there's an evolution of spirit or of consciousness, and it really, and to put it in down-to-earth terms, it's a function of growing up. It's a function of maturing as human, as unlimited spiritual beings. It's not something that is weird. It's not like you have to go on some kind of, you know, 2-week hike in the Andes or something to get this. But it's a function of gradually becoming who we really are, which in my opinion is a unlimited spiritual being in a spiritual world. I think I am doing my best to accelerate this. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I'm trying to get out there, because we only have one shot at this. In other words, even though reincarnation might be true, and even though there might be life after death, I know that I'm here now, and so it's good. It's good if this happens in my lifetime. That's my quest. That's why I am pushing this. So.
Yeah, it seems it does seem that it's right upon us now. It was interesting because, you know, many religious leaders, including Jesus, thought that the apocalypse was imminent, but it evidently wasn't. We weren't ready for it 2,000 years ago.
Right.
But now there are signs, and there does seem to be, I guess, a quickening or an awakening of diverse people. It's not one religion. It's not one nation. It seems to be more generalized. And I mean, what we've been basically introduced to is the idea that an energy is coming in that is behind this awakening. And when the energy hits the individual, and I'm not saying it would be in the material world, it would probably be in a higher realm, but when this energy hits the individual, if they are on the right track, it propels them toward waking up. But if they're in the wrong track, it's gonna shut them down, you know, energetically shut them down. Yeah. So that is what we're seeing is people who are optimistic and who are pursuing spiritual, you know, activities and ideas. They're becoming more and more intuitive. They're becoming, they have more synchronicities happening, and we can talk about what synchronicities are. And then the people who are more negative are having more and more trouble. They're getting sicker. They have more financial trouble. They're having, you know, things aren't working in their world now, with a certain selfish, individual, viewpoint that is not, it's just not working anymore. And I guess that brings up the idea is, what do you see? I mean, if there is an energy behind this, how do you see that? Where do you see that coming from, or how do you see that working?
Well, I view it, I mean, I think a metaphor would be maybe a volcano. where the energy is sort of contained and then eventually it erupts. I think that's one metaphor. Another metaphor would be a flower, the blossoming of a flower. I mean, I think you have the poetic and you have the, you know, the super energetic. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a, I think, you know, I've given this some thought because it's you have to look at things differently, but I do think there's a aspect of it takes a village. I think there's something to be said for that, or a critical mm-hmm. mass, a snowball. You know, these types of metaphors are the best that I can do to capture it because we're not on a solo journey here.
Right,
The critical mass, this scientific revolution, this paradigm shift, is going to take power, but it's not going to take a majority of people. It's going to take
a sort of an
irresistible force kind of a thing, where it builds mm-hmm. up power because it's true, and it picks up steam like a snowball would pick up steam, or pick up, I really mixed metaphors there, would pick up snow and, you know, and become bigger. And so mm-hmm. I think the power, people don't understand sometimes, we don't appreciate the power of truth. The power, if something is true, it's like the law of gravity is an example here. It's, mm-hmm. you know, you jump out of a building and, you know, you're going to fall. And it's something you cannot ignore that. And so what I'm saying, we cannot ignore the substratum, the foundation of our world. I mean, you use mm-hmm. some really good examples there about when you fight the world, when you fight that, whether we call it the karmic field or whether mm-hmm. we call it the way or the harmony. When you fight that wave, you're in trouble. It's not going to happen for you because it's sort of like you are going against the theme of the story. You're an outlier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all these things, you know, I just think it's better living with trying to catch the wave and, trying to get with the flow and seeing where it leads you. It's a much more sort of promising, uplifting way to live. And it does work. I mean, everything you're saying, like, you know, the synchronicities, good things happen, you're healthier, maybe the eternal quest of staying younger longer. All these mm-hmm. things are visions that keep you going, keep me going. So I do think we are seeing the wave pick up power here. And again, it's still slow because to me we got to burst down the walls of materialism to really have the
victory
here.
Right. Yeah.
So and that's going to be a while.
Well, and also, I mean, if you look at how at least in the United States, it seems like the majority of people are still asleep. They're still asleep at the wheel. I mean, they're not concerned with anything other than their narrow world. And if you bring in anything of more importance, especially the things that need changing, all it does is disrupt them and make them go further inside. They don't want to acknowledge that anything's wrong outside their tiny world. You know, there's lots of things wrong outside their tiny world,
yeah.
You know? I mean, the Constitution's being threatened. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff if you want to. I mean, even the Bill of Rights is being threatened now. So, you know, but it seems that when people start waking up to the greater truths and also the greater problems that need everybody to wake up so that we can vote the right people into power to maintain things that are important to us, I think people will wake up, you know, all very, very much all at once. But it may take some great, I guess, problems and some real examples to prove to people they need to get out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, it's going to be, I think it's a function of leadership and mm-hmm. who is leading the charge, who is defining the story of our lives, who's writing the script. And when you mm-hmm. think about it, the two big ones are the religious leaders, like the Pope and all those guys, and then the leading scientists, the professors, the Nobel Prize winners. They are we have put them in charge of answering the big questions.
Right.
And we sort of get their answers and we plug them into our brains through reading the newspaper, science magazine, or watching the show The Cosmos on TV. And we or the TV preachers, and we just sort of put that in there and we go off on our merry ways and put food on the table. And what I'm saying is that, you know, I quote Socrates a lot on this, but he said the unexamined life is not worth living. At some point in your life, you got to hit the pause button and examine those fundamental beliefs with the same rigor that a lot of people question Obamacare or who question, you know, substitution patterns of the basketball coach or hairstylist or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
we
have all this rigor. You know, we get all emotionally charged up over these political things, but but then when someone tells us what to think about the Big Bang or evolution or what God is, we say, okay, well, thank you. Well, you know, I have no questions. I'm just, I accept that. You know, and so it's sort of, this is what is so important. I mean, so we have to change the messaging. And so, and frankly, I don't know whether this is, how much of this is going to be grassroots from the bottom up or how much of it is top down. But I do think that changing the message from the top, if we have a couple leaders, I mean, Oprah is out there, and if we have, we need a Gandhi, we need a Martin Luther King, we need a John F. Kennedy. You need people who break with this orthodoxy and say, "Hey, this is, we've been wrong, and we have a new way to look at this, and this is, and we've decided that we need to rewrite some books." I mean, this is a real revolutionary thing here, Susan. But it's great fun. And we are at a time here where I hope something dramatic is going to happen. So that's about that. That's what makes our time so interesting.
I have noticed that on some of the channels, not maybe mainstream, but other TV channels, there have been some interesting shows with some interesting ideas. I'm trying to think of the name of the show, but Brian Greene did a narrative that was very interesting. I think it might have been on The Universe, I'm not sure, about time and space being all occurring at the same time. You know, all time and space occurring at the same time. Did you see that at all? Did you see that show?
Yeah, I have seen some of Brian Greene's shows, and I think I have one on DVDs. I'm actually... There's a concept show that I'm working on right now. I don't know if it's going to be picked up, but it's called Rethink is the concept right now, where it's based upon rethinking some of these same sort of historical beliefs that we've been raised with. But it is encouraging, even though I may not agree personally with Brian Greene or Stephen Hawking or everything Neil deGrasse is saying on the cosmos, it is good, you know, in the big picture that the public is being exposed to these big ideas, and because it allows everyone to question them and think about them themselves, and it's not just, you know, the province of the PhDs. And it's something that's always bothered me, and inspiration for me. For what it's worth, is that I remember when I was young and my mother had a friend over and she was complaining about how she couldn't understand what the scientists were saying and how frustrated she was. It was a really big influence on me, because I think that is, you know, the scientists and even the religious folks, we need to speak in a language so that the American public and the public at large could understand them. So the truth is not that complicated. It shouldn't be that complicated. And yet, you know, the Higgs boson, for example, the God particle, who in the heck understands what that is? I mean, it's supposed to be some dramatic discovery, but so far I haven't seen any impact it's had on the real world. So in any event, I've mixed together some things there. But at the end of the day, I am optimistic that the truth will remain standing, and that if we continue to question the big ideas, be exposed to them, and start thinking for ourselves, we're going to be at a place where we could reach agreement on some of these big ideas and not fight each other over them.
And I think that the idea of these, you know, the Science Channel, the History Channel, the, you know, these Discovery Channel, these kind of networks would allow more diverse viewpoints to come on, and then allow the people who are talented at explaining these things. Because, you know, the problem is when you break everything down to mathematics, a lot of people aren't good at mathematics, so you lose them there. But some of the, like what Brian Greene was doing, the diagrams, the graphics that are able to be put on the TV can take mathematical concepts and show them to people who may not be real savvy in mathematics. I think that's the beauty of these networks that are presenting stuff that really wasn't presented until just a few years ago on TV at all.
Yeah, and we have a challenge right now. I'm trying to move this forward in my own little way, which is that we have a dichotomy right now on the media. When you think about it, we have the quote unquote legitimate science programs, with the Cosmos being the best example right now, and then the Brian Greene shows. And then we have these outlier shows, you know, the Ghost Hunters, Paranormal Searches, these sort of the shows which are trying to, you know, seek attention by being out there, controversial. It's sort of like the scientists have the big tent in the circus, and then there's the freak show, which is the paranormal, the Ghost Hunters. And what I'm saying is that we need to have one tent. We need to bring the credible people, such as the Dean Radins of the world, Rupert Sheldrake, the people that have done experiments. There's so many of these people right now that are legitimate, that have done scientific experiments. We need to start bringing those people on the mainstream TV stations and start opening up the dialogue to show that the materialistic approach doesn't explain everything. In fact, it explains very little at the end of the day. It has to ignore, they have to ignore the entire realm of the paranormal, the supernatural, a holistic metaphor.
The world of miracles.
The whole world. I mean, it really amazes me that they have this thing called the theory of everything. But they've defined everything to not include 80% of the world, which is the theory of everything only is particles and forces. It's not religiousness, it's not spirituality, it's not the paranormal, the parapsychology, the supernatural, et cetera, et cetera. So how can you say that you have a theory of everything when you haven't, by definition, explained everything? I'm thinking that in the next 10 years, we should be seeing the media loosen up a little bit and opening the doors to more credible new ideas, you know, outside the realm of that movie, What the Bleep Do You Know, which was a little, you know, it was interesting, but I don't think that did much for this movement, because it was a little odd. But at least it opened up some minds. But I'm thinking that something on the same production value as the Cosmos or one of the Brian Greene shows, but start showing, you know, where this
something
world
outside
is
of just science,
because those shows are
about science, and science has its boundaries. I mean, it's bound in the third dimension primarily. So in medicine, I like to tell people that, you know, you're never going to understand the cause of cancer if you can't explain spontaneous remission. I've seen spontaneous remission. It's an energy that starts at the crown, goes to the feet, and in that time period of that energy going through the body, all metastatic disease disappears. So it's pretty clear that the cause of cancer cannot reside entirely in the third dimension.
Yeah. No, that's that's really good, because I do think medicine, I mean, I think there needs to be more media attention on the success of holistic energetic cures,
mm-hmm.
whatever you call them, I mean, whatever we're calling them, because there's more and more credible people proving the truth of
mm-hmm.
of these energetic healing or the spiritual healing or the power of belief, all these things. It's exciting.
Yeah.
And
well, the power of forgiveness. I mean,
right.
Forgiveness is changing your mind about something. Really, I mean, it's letting something go and not having it just stick in there, and then that is associated with, in some cases, spontaneous remission of cancer.
Yes.
I mean, how do you explain that? That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's great. And getting back to my original model about the, you know, creations of a universal mind being more powerful than the creations of a single mind. I am very, very enamored with the concept that the more people that you have believing in the power of forgiveness or spirit or energy,
mm-hmm.
the more success we're going to have with these cures. It's
mm-hmm.
it's like teamwork always builds the power of the team. The rowboat rowed in the same direction goes faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I
right.
think that's where scientific experimentation needs to go. And I you know, there is some out there. Dean Radin has done some of this, and
mm-hmm,
I think Rupert
yeah.
Sheldrake, and there are some experiments about, you know, does the mass of folks who are following the same path, does it improve the results? And so I think that's a great
mm-hmm.
field of study that opens up a whole new avenue, a whole new area of scientific exploration. You know, I don't think science is going to end. I think science itself is going to evolve.
Yeah, one example of that is an experiment that William Tiller did with having meditators who were fairly advanced concentrate on changing the pH of water. And actually doing so.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really good example of what we're talking about here, because, you know, the pH of water shouldn't be able to be changed by the mind, okay?
Right,
I mean,
right.
not in a materialistic world, you know?
Right.
But when you start doing things like changing random number generators, like they've shown with the PEAR engineering project around the time when attention is focused on one event, world attention is focused on one event, you know, when you change the pH of water, when you do other things that are shouldn't be able to be done, except if the world is a giant thought rather than a giant machine.
Right.
That I think that's real exciting in terms of the experiments that are coming out, you know, from various scientists.
Yeah, it's really an exciting development, what you're saying. I mean, there's so much of it, and it connects to religion and morality as well, and this
mm-hmm.
is what makes it so powerful, because, you know, do unto others as you would have them do to you. The golden rule, it's saying combine over that over which there you have no doubt. We all know
mm-hmm.
the function, the truth of morality, and it's another way of saying, you know, act as brothers and sisters, act as a family, and then you will see, you know, without getting overly religious here, then you see the kingdom of heaven on earth,
right.
et cetera.
I think
that's where this heads, and again,
it
goes
yeah.
right, and it's really we are such a doubting group of people. I mean, it is amazing to me. How we doubt everything, which is fine. I mean, it shows we're using our brains, using, you know, political leaders and football coaches and basketball coaches are usually the targets of our doubts.
Mm-hmm.
But but if something isn't doubtable, if you doubt it and it remains and it's still true, it's got to tell you there's something to it. And so I just think, as I said earlier, we need to apply the doubt to these false beliefs that we've been raised with over the body being machine, for example. Get over it and start researching some of these other developments, like you're saying, and start experimenting ourselves with the power of belief, the power of forgiveness.
Yeah.
And it really pays dividends.
Well, you know, I've been doing Temple of Health radio show for about 17 years, and every
wow.
week I interview a different author. So you can imagine everybody I've interviewed, everybody you've mentioned, other than, I haven't interviewed Sheldrake, but I think it's just because he's not doing interviews. But basically, if people want to go back and look at the archives of the show, you know, many of these scientists have been on talking about the experiments and the findings that we're talking about here. And you know, it's kind of interesting that you know, many radio shows like the one I have are on the air now, and probably even 25 years ago there were very few people talking about or writing books or even
right.
talking about what we're talking about outside of, say, philosophy or religion.
Right.
Academic.
Right. Right. That, right. That's really promising. Right. That is really promising. I mean, another way to look at it is, 25, 30 years ago, I'm dating myself here. If you went to the quote-unquote New Age bookstore section or New Science section, you would see the Tao of Physics, the Dancing Wulu Masters, and then there
right.
was the...
Here Now.
The Aquarian Conspiracy. There was
a
couple of books, and now
right.
there's thousands of books on this
yeah,
area.
There is.
And it
right.
really is. It's showing that people's minds are opening, that things are that we're exploring these heretofore uncharted territories. And I think it's promising. I mean, frankly, 20 years ago, when I finished the first draft of my book, I was a real outlier. And
I'll bet.
At this point in time, I think I'm extremely radical, but I'm not as radical as I'm not too radical. I think that the everything is leading in this direction, and I'm hoping now's the time is right to put into practice. To integrate into our mindset, into our textbooks, in other words, our teachings, TV, that we're not in a forever locked into this false dichotomy between religion and science. This is not engraved in stone. This is a mental state that we need to grow out of, and combine the two, be spiritual and logical at the same time. And that's where I think and I hope things are heading. So it does take a village. So Hillary was right about that.
All right. And also, you can't just stay within one discipline. You have to educate yourself, as you have done, in religion, science, philosophy, and metaphysics, which are all separate endeavors.
Right.
You have to bring them all together, and it's only through the synthesis of the ideas are you going to be able to grasp the idea that you're putting forth in the book here, is that the universe is a giant thought of one mind rather than a thing or a mechanistic proposal. And then once we understand that it is a projection of consciousness, then we can start to change that. And I think that's where your book gets very exciting about what does it mean once we really realize the true nature of reality, how we can change what is projected.
Right, right. As you put, as you said earlier about people being, quote-unquote, asleep at the wheel, another way to frame that is to say that we believe that the universe is on autopilot, that it's operating on its own power, that we just sort of wake up and everything just goes its merry way. We have no effect on it. Well, I think it's manually controlled. It's manually controlled. And we need to take the pen out and write our own story. That's the other metaphor I would use here, that we if you're going to sit down and you're going to write a story of what you want to be, I think, and you were unlimited, most people would write themselves being a hero in some kind of quest story where they become, you know, immortal, or they become an angel or a god or whatever. Write the story, that the highest story that you could think of, and that is the beauty of this view of the world, is that it is unlimited, and we're only limited by our beliefs that we are limited.
Right.
And if somebody wants to say, well, that's just poppycock, I would say, number one, prove to me it's wrong, and number two, it's a lot more inspirational to have this view, even if the world was a machine. This is what the great athletes, composers, artists have done over time, is that they don't view themselves as being limited. They see the sky's the limit. This is what we've been raised to learn. And over time, the material world sort of puts this downward pressure on our trajectories. And so it is a very, I hope, uplifting view. It's something I tell people. I'm probably the best example of my own philosophy, because I'm basically a normal person from Cleveland, and I view this as something I can do, and I set myself to it, and I wrote the book, and here I am. And so it's something that I set myself up to do, and it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. A lot of the books I had to read are very good cures for insomnia. but you know, I always had this goal that I was going to accomplish, and the harder part is probably going to be breaking down the walls of materialism, but you got to start somewhere. So
Got
to get the book out there and make the arguments and get people to open their minds and read it and think through the ideas.
Yeah, I have a sign. Actually, it's above the water cooler in our office here. It's by I think it's Richard Bach. It says, "Argue for your limitations and they are yours," which is the opposite of what you just said.
Exactly. You know, I mean, there's in sales. It's funny. There's there's this book called The Little Red Book of Selling, there's something in there about. There's a line about ignore the pukers, which is another way of saying ignore the negative people
right.
that bring you down. There's always the naysayers in the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, I use that as motivation. You know, it's like somebody telling Michael Jordan in high school that he wasn't good enough to make the team. I mean, look what it did to him. Look what it did to him.
Yeah.
I mean, it inspired him
it didn't
to be.
Stop him.
Yeah, it inspired him. And so it really is, it's an exciting thing. But, you know, you learn overall that it does take a team.
Mm-hmm.
It does take a family. It does take group effort. You can't, like, battle the masses by yourself. You have to roll with the wave.
Yeah, I had somebody come up to me the other day and say something interesting. They said to me, "Dr. Kolb, you told me I would never walk again, and look at me." But the funny thing is I never told that person they wouldn't walk again. But in their mind, they made me into the person that, you know, like told Michael Jordan he wasn't good enough to make the team, and then used that to get out of the wheelchair.
Because
I just would never tell somebody they won't walk again, because I do believe in miracles, you know. I believe that if you can walk again. But it is interesting that people will create what they need to create to get their, you know, to get the kick in the butt they need to do what they need to do.
Yeah, well, there's
even
there's
if it's
a...
making something up.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how many people get those wrong impressions. But, you know, inside of us, when I talk about desires and what is most fundamental for us, and one of the fundamental features of our being, I think, that cannot be ignored, is the will to live. And that is something that Darwin called the struggle for existence. William James had a book called The Will to Live, and it was also something. And Schopenhauer, the 18th century, I think he was a German idealist philosopher. You know, the will to live. You can't. We all have this will to make it, and and so that's really what we need to tap. We need to tap that will, that striving, that incessant desire to get more out of life. And that's, you know, I think that speaks to that patient that made up your advice. You know, you know, you sort of look for that motivation, and there's something about doubters that inspire, or naysayers.
Right.
You know?
There's something. I'm going to show you.
There's something about that, and I really do think that if there's one thing that unites us, we all have that will to live, and some of us, unfortunately, channel that in the wrong direction. You know, the will to have the biggest house, or to have the most money in the bank, or the fastest car, or whatever, but it really is a function of wanting to live, and wanting to survive and strive after something. And so we need to tap that power, that energy, and point it towards a productive destiny. So.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give the listeners your contact information, as well as, I guess, a summary and inspirational message from your book?
Sure. Okay. First of all, the website is thecollapseofmaterialism.com, which is also the name of the book. And my email address is Philip with one L, Camella, Comella, @gmail.com. I'd be happy to respond to any questions. In terms of the book, I try to make it understandable, approachable by anybody. I said earlier about how important that is to me, that truth and all these big ideas are not just the business of the PhDs. And if there's any idea I think that I would leave the listener with, is that we only have one shot at this. We have one life, and you need to hit that pause button and think about the big questions. And what I try to do in this book is help the reader along with dealing with these big questions, and ask yourself whether there's a way we can join this unquenchable desire, this spiritual urge we have inside, with the physical world, and try to make a better place for all of us. So that's really what it is. It's trying to be spiritual, be logical, and I do think there's a way to do it. And so that's really what my book is about, viewing the world as a great dream, not a great machine.
Yeah, well, I loved your book. I thought it was really good. It was I too pursued a similar path with looking at various works and authors in different fields of endeavor, and came up with very much the same conclusion. And you know, remember when I told you about that dream I had, that that something outside of this realm is projecting both the dream world and the real world. What happens is, when you go on this quest, you get help like that, which is really interesting. And so you get some guidance along the way from perhaps a higher aspect of yourself that has a better view of what really is going on. And that's always exciting. Yeah, that's a great thing of spiritual development, is that communication and those things outside.
Yes.
But I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great conversation, and I encourage people to read The Collapse of Materialism. Thanks a lot.
Well, Susan, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and best of luck to you, and thanks everyone for listening.
Great. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Philip Camella on The Collapse of Materialism, and next week we're going to interview Gary Null, Reboot Your Brain, A Natural Approach to Fight Memory Loss. And then the week after that, Brent Baum, Surviving Trauma School Earth, A Practical Guide to Emotional Survival on the Earth Plane. Dr. Garth Nicholson is coming on in early June to talk about the health and anti-aging benefits of lipid replacement therapy. And then Dr. Norm Shealy is going to be speaking about Living Bliss, Major Discoveries Along the Holistic Path. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.